Okay, we're back on. We had a disruption with the phone ringing, and now I'm back on with Maria Clapp. Okay. Can you tell me your experiences as a a working woman at the time? And
I was always liberated, so to speak. And even after I was married, my husband and I had a 50-50, really, marriage. And he respected me in many ways. And as far as education went, or anything having to do with the decorating of the house or anything like that, we would go together on and agree. But that was my part of the bargain. And anything that had to do with business or insurance or anything like that, or the house repairs, anything, that was his area. And we, although we talked everything over, we each had our fields of expertise, and we each honored the other's intelligence as far as certain areas were concerned. So I, as I say, they had the women's liberation. I always felt liberated, and I was very blessed that way to have a husband that felt the same way as I did.
Can you talk about when you came back to teach in Hudson, where you lived, and till the present?
Well, when, excuse me, after I was married, we lived in Stuyvesant in a little house, and it was fine, but I never taught where I resided. And I finally got back to Hudson again, and I lived in the same town as where I was working. My husband worked in Albany. He was claims manager of the Maryland Casualty Company, and his office was in Albany, but he didn't have the strict hours that I had. I had to be at the school at 8 o'clock no matter what, because the children arrived, no matter what kind of weather or anything else. So it was much better for me to live actually where I had to work. And I'm sorry, but I lost my way. Forgot what you asked me.
Oh, the different places that you lived in after you came back to teach.
Yeah. Well, first in Stuyvesant, when I was teaching in Hudson. First, when I taught, when I had my job in Kinderhook, I lived in Hudson, wrong place. Then when I moved to Stuyvesant, wrong place again, because I taught in Hudson. Finally, we built the house that we live in now in the 50s, and we built the house after my father had had a massive heart attack. They said he wasn't going to live for more than a year, so when we built the house, we were in the process of building it. So instead of taking the two-car garage as a garage, we turned the two-car garage into an apartment for my mother and father. And the two-car garage, most of the area, was their living room. And then in the former plans that we had a den. And so we made that, they built the living room and the den. They built right on the same level, and they were able to add some closets and things, and so that the den became my mother and father's bedroom, and that was also huge. compared to the bedrooms that people have now. And then you would walk out into a hall and there was the bathroom. And then you walked further through a hall and there was the kitchen. Then if you followed and turned left, we had a big dining room that my mother and father and my husband and I all shared. And as we did share the kitchen. And then you'd come into my living room, which was on the other side of the house. And so we added the two-car garage on the opposite side so that we could have an apartment for my mother if anything happened to my father, because he was not expected to live. Well, everything was wonderful. My husband and my family never had a cross word. Never. My husband had a beautiful disposition, and he was very fond of my mother and father, as they were of him. I won't say that I didn't have a cross word once in a while, but with my mother, but two women living together, you know, it's kind of hard. But we managed, and we loved each other very, very much. And as it turned out, my father lived, oh, I ought to tell you more about the house. We had bedrooms upstairs, a bedroom and a guest room upstairs and a bath, full bath. And then when my father and mother still entertained, we changed living rooms. And my husband and I would come in here where we are now. And they would take over our living room, and we had doors, lattice doors that would close so everybody could have their privacy. And then my mother would take over and have the dining room and everything. And of course we had double everything, appliances. That was the bane of my existence for a while, because I didn't know where to put it all. We have a huge basement, so that's where we stored the extras. But all while my mother and father lived with us, as they got older, I did all the cooking. My mother did not. And my mother stopped working after my brother went to Colgate and Yale. He was a lawyer. He's passed away now. And anyway, the apartment was wonderful because my dad lived longer than my husband did. He lived for 20 years after they said he wouldn't live more than a year. And my husband died before my father did. My dad was 92, my age now, and my mom was 96 when she passed away. And she was an invalid for 8 years, but we had this huge living room that I now call my TV room and my office. That's a laugh, really, about the office. But anyway, my husband died before my father did. My husband was only 62. And he died of a massive heart attack. And then gradually, my father passed away after 20 years of living. And then my mother was still with me. And then she became an invalid, and she was an invalid for 8 years. And I was able to get a hospital bed and still have loads of room in the living room. And I was able to put her in front of the three windows. And when I'd have guests, and every New Year's, my husband had passed away even when he did. My friends still came here for New Year's Eve. And we had a toast with champagne. And we'd all come in this side of the house with my mother. And she'd have a glass of champagne with us too, sitting up in her hospital bed. And we just had a wonderful, wonderful arrangement throughout my whole life. And as I say, I was very blessed with a wonderful husband. And the only hard thing about our marriage was that I was unable to have children. And when we wanted to adopt them, it was during and just after the war, and there were no available children. And after a while, I began to feel that maybe God had another plan for me. And so I continued to teach for as long as I did. So I have many children, really, and some of them, you know, they're grandmothers now, and they meet me in the grocery store and hug me, and it's so rewarding, I can't tell you, when they remember you with such love. It's really great.
And can you tell me, you mentioned your Uncle Willie. Can you tell me about Uncle Willie's family and things that you did with Uncle Willie's family?
You misunderstood me. I didn't mean, it wasn't Willie. It was, Mr. Petrie that owned the garage?
Yes.
Well, as I say, years ago, his garage was the only garage between that sold cars. There were no car dealerships or anything between New York City and Albany. My dad went to work there very young, put cars together, and worked there for a long time until Will, not Willie.
Oh, Will.
Uncle Will, yeah, Petrie. And then, of course, time was going by. Uncle Will died and had no business anymore. My father went into his own business with a man named Mr. Hoover, and Bill William Hoover, and my dad had a business for many, many years on Columbia Street, right across from where the municipal parking lot is now. Mm-hmm.
Were you related to Uncle Will?
Oh, yes. He was my uncle.
Uh-huh.
And he had a wonderful family with my, my Aunt Leela was his wife. And she had, she had two older boys. And then she had my Aunt Bertha. And then she had Blanche, she had a big family. And then her next boy was also named William, and he was a doctor. And he wasn't around Hudson very much, except just to come home and visit. And then the youngest son was Robert. They were a wonderful family, and we were very close. And after everybody was gone, Bertha was left all alone, and I took care of Bertha also. She'd call me up in the middle of the night and say, Bob is here and he wants to see you. And I'd say, no, Bertha, Bob is in heaven. He can't be there. Oh, yes, he is, she'd say. And she was really losing her memory, and I don't think she had Alzheimer's, but she was deteriorating. And so sometimes I knew she was kind of frantic. She'd call and she'd say, Bob is here, he wants to see you. And I knew then that something was going on with her, and she was scared, because she lived alone on Union Street. And so I get up in the middle of the night, because we lived here at River Ledge with my mom and dad, my husband, and I'd go down to Bertha's on Union Street to see what was the matter. And she would never lock her doors, and I was frightened for her, because people used to walk in the house. And, you know, she might even be sleeping. And I had trouble with one man who came, and all he did was fix her thermostat. And he'd come morning, and he'd come at night. And every time he came, she'd pay him. And because I had control kind of her money, and the lawyer and I'd give her so much a week. And then she'd always tell me, I'd say, now how much money you got, Bertha? You know, we got to get some groceries. And sometimes her money would be gone. I'd give her $50 and it would be gone. And she was giving it to this man who was using her. And she thought he was wonderful, wonderful friend, you know, taking care of her heat. I said, Bertha, you put the heat in a certain way, and I'll put it there and just leave it. Nobody needs to come, and I'm going to tell him he mustn't come anymore because you're giving him money. She says, not very much, but she didn't realize how much money she was giving him. And so she'd tell me that she gave it to the church, and for a while I believed her. And then after a while, I don't know, I happened to talk to Father Bath, and he said, we haven't had any contribution from Mrs. Redmond in a long time. And I said, I can't believe that. And so anyway, so I went back to her and said, Bertha, you're telling me a fib. You're giving it to this man, and he shall remain nameless because I wouldn't want to ruin his reputation. But I waited for him, and I told him, I said, I'm going to have you arrested. And if you come here in this house one more time and I catch you, I said, I'm going to have you arrested because you're taking this woman's money. He says, no, I'm not taking it. She wants to give it to me. I said, oh, yes. And all you're doing is telling her you're fixing the thermostat for the heat. I said, oh, no, no more of that. Now, I said, mind my words. I mean what I say. If you come here ever again, I'm going to have the police arrest you. And so he never came again. He must have believed that what I said and had no more trouble with him. But the family was a wonderful family. And we lived through all the trials and tribulations of any family.
And we have about, you know, we're almost done with the interview. Is there anything that you'd like to say that you haven't said?
I don't think so. I've rambled on and on. I hope somebody will find it interesting, but I don't know if you really will or not.
You've mentioned people that were important in your life, like your mom and dad and your husband, obviously. Is there anybody else?
And I have a wonderful cousin who is 92 also. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to mention her name because she might not like to have me mention it.
Okay.
But she's been wonderful to me too. Okay. And she still drives and is able to. But that time will come soon. I had to give up driving a year ago because I got these attacks of vertigo, and I never could tell when I was going to get one, and I wouldn't take a chance. I've got a wonderful car that I've willed to my nephew, and I just told him, you know, he better come and get the car. It's an old car, but it has had wonderful, you know, care. Mm-hmm. It's typical of the old lady that just goes to the church and to the grocery store. It has probably about 27,000 miles on it, and it's a 1998 Mercury Mystique. So every time I took it to a garage, they all wanted to buy it because they knew that I kept it up. It's in great running shape, has two new tires on it. And it's just a great car. But I willed it to my nephew, so I said, it's your responsibility now. So we're in the midst of a lot of turmoil with insurance and all that stuff.
I know you mentioned that you lived in this house for 50 years.
That's right.
Can you tell me a little bit about what changes, if anything, in the neighborhood during this past 50 years?
Oh, yeah, the neighborhood. There is only one other person in the neighborhood that was here when we built the house. And then there are children of the neighbors in a couple of the houses, but all the rest of them are completely different. I have a lady state trooper that lives across the street from me now, and she was talking with my niece, and she said, we're keeping track of your aunt. And I said, oh, that's really nice to know. So I have some very nice neighbors, but I don't know them like I used to know the old neighbors. Mm-hmm. Our neighborhood was quite closely knit, but now there have been too many changes.
Mm-hmm. And can you tell me or mention your fondest memory with your niece?
With Suzanne?
With Suzanne.
Well, Suzanne and her brother Ren. His name is Jay Reynolds Perley, and we call him Ren. They used to come to visit when they were little children. And typical school teacher that I was, you know, they minded me, but they loved to come. We had a lot of nice memories with them. And they've continued with me through thick and thin. And they think of me as their mother rather than as their aunt. And it's very gratifying to know, too. You know, I just talked with Ren on the phone about the car. I said, you've got to do something about the car. And he said, well, you know, what about it? I said, I told you when you were here the last time. The car is yours. I willed it to him. And so I said, it's your responsibility. I don't want anything more to do with it. So we're in the process of canceling insurance and taking the plates off and all that stuff. But he seemed to think that he'd have a hard time selling it. But anybody that knows me, and it's a good-looking car still, there are no dents or rust spots or anything like that on it. I kept it up well. In fact, I never had an accident in my life, and I have driven since 1941. Two people ran into me, and I had to have the dents taken out. I was up at the hospital and had driven, because I work one day a month at the hospital, the information desk, because I can sit and still be useful, because I belong to the hospital auxiliary, among other organizations. And so anyway, lost my train of thought, thinking about too many things. I was talking about the different organizations. Oh, and as I told you, I got this vertigo thing, and so I haven't driven in a year. Mm-hmm. So my cousin has been wonderful, because she takes me to church and to the auxiliary meetings, the hospital auxiliary meetings, and I belong to a group called the Fortnightly Club. It's been in existence over 200 years, and I enjoy going there. We have speakers, and we're only on the committee, and that's a simple thing.
What does that club do?
Well, originally it was founded by the founders of the city of Hudson. And they founded the club because there was no cultural nothing cultural in the city when they came, the proprietors. And so they banded together, and they were all wealthy people, and they used to have the meetings in their homes because they had servants and everything. And then the men would always take charge. Now we just have ladies, because years ago the men said they were tired of being the speaker. We have speakers, and then we have tea. And it's really a social club now. It reverted to that because, in fact, the churches belong. Mrs. Church belonged to the Fort Niley, you know, the Frederick Church, the artist that had that lived in Olana. Well, that's as far back as we go as an organization. And then later on, the ladies were in charge of a meeting, and they had to speak on some topic. Then after that, they did book reviews, the women did. And then after a while, the women said, you know, we work on so many other charitable, in so many other charitable organizations that, you know, we'd like to just come and just enjoy ourselves. So now, what we do, we're allowed 50 members, and all we do is have a social time, but we have a speaker, somebody that's always very interesting, and then and you have to be voted into the group too. That's another thing. Everybody can't belong, and a lot of the younger people rebel at that, you know, and I can understand why. But this has been going on for over 200 years.
Well, what's the criteria that you use to allow people to be a member?
People wanted to, in the beginning, as I say, it was the proprietors. And then as it got on and on and on, now just people who know other people in the club, they're recommended, you know, that they'd be a good member. And, but we've served our day serving others, and so now we just like to be entertained. And then what we do is, I was chairman last year, and we of one of our meetings, and we have meetings beginning in October. We have a luncheon, and then we go on until Christmas, and then we have a hiatus during Christmas because the weather's so bad and people from all around the county belong. And then we go back again in April, and then we have finished up for the year now, so that people that go to Florida too, you know, you have to attend so many meetings a year. They've gotten kind of lax with that because there's so many people now that are on the go, you know. But all we have to do is you arrange for the tea table, and we still have an old custom of a receiving line, which is kind of quaint. But we still keep to the old customs. And then each member of the committee is in charge of making two loaves of sandwiches, tea sandwiches, and then cookies and things like that. And we just enjoy each other. It's a way to meet people, other people, than you would ordinarily come in contact with.
Sure. And what's the age range of people in the group?
Oh, well, of course, I'm the oldest. I've been in it 30 years, and after 25, you can stop. But I was having such a good time, I don't mind making the sandwiches and doing the minimum, you know, amount of work. So I stayed in, but I'm 92, and the ladies have to be people who can have Friday afternoons is when we meet. We meet fortnightly. We meet twice a month. And it's a wonderful organization. So I would say that ranges all the way from in the 40s, the late 40s, to me, 92.
That's really
And my cousin,
wonderful.
Who's also 92, she's in it.
That's wonderful. We're going to end now, and I know I've taken up a lot of your time. Is there anything that you'd want to say about Hudson, about someone who's never been to Hudson ever? What's the most important things you'd want them to know about Hudson?
It still is rural in flavor, but it has a real cosmopolitan population, and there are lovely, beautiful antique stores, and other stores as well are coming, and the restaurants are really, you know, they're New York caliber restaurants, and you just have to go 5 miles and you're out in the real country area. Hudson has a lot to offer culturally, and it's really made a real comeback thanks to the people who moved here from New York. They have summer homes here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm sure.